good evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion. That'll determine what the future will bring, and I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, if you're out there across America, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because we have with us this evening a very interesting young man who's I've met on a number of occasions, lives up in the Spokane area, adjacent to Spokane, and he's really totally dedicated to trying to reintroduce into our country an understanding of the magnificence of the American Constitution. Now, most people don't understand that America was created as a Christian nation. It was created by Christians, not that you couldn't have other religions here, but it was based upon Christian principles. And one of those was, of course, that men are basically sinful. And that was why they wanted to take the chains off of the people and put the chains onto government. For as Thomas Jefferson had said so well in matters of politics, speak not to me of confidence in men, but rather bind them down for mischief by the chains of the Constitution. And so the Constitution was really an amazing, amazing document because it was made with checks and balances so that nobody could ever gain too much power. It was had the addition of having limitations placed on what the government could do, not only in Article 1, Section 8, but in the 10th Amendment, which specifically restricted what Congress could do, because the last thing our founder fathers wanted was a democracy where the officials in government could do whatever they wanted to. And, of course, they didn't want them to have power because they knew they would be corrupted and they'd be bought and sold by other wealthy people. And so the Constitution stood America in good stead for certainly 150 years or more. But then, of course, as so often happens, they're greedy and evil and wicked people, and they were here from their very inception, and they always wanted to gain control of our government and use it to bring about a new world order and a new world religion. But you had to gain control of Washington, D.C., and you had to circumvent the Constitution. So we don't teach the Constitution and the Bill of Rights in schools, or if we do, we alter what's being done, as they do with the new federal guidelines and federal standards for education, where they teach our children about the Bill of Rights and how it's almost as good as the International Declaration of Rights. But, of course, they never really tell them about the Second Amendment or the Tenth Amendment or the idea that there are limitations placed on government. And they never tell them that you can't amend the Constitution except with great difficulty. They tell them that the Supreme Court can amend the Constitution any way, time they want to. And the federal standards for education are designed specifically and intentionally to destroy our understanding of the Constitution. Well, Neil Davis is set about to do something about that. Neil, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, why don't you tell us what happened when you had Mike Perutka up there talking to your people? I understand you had a tremendous meeting there, the graduation of your first Institute on the Constitution.
Yes, we had 37 graduates, and it was really a wonderful event. Michael Perutka from the Institute on the Constitution, and Perutka and Perutka is his law firm in Baltimore. He flew out and spoke to our group on 1 million lawyers, what if they were all like Patrick Henry? And we had a wonderful turnout. It was very encouraging to us here in Spokane. We had about 100 folks here.
Well, that's really encouraging. To get 100 people out is quite a task, and I'm so pleased. I hope that you're going to be able to begin setting up other institutes on the Constitution, because we have to start someplace, and I know Mike has set these units up all across America. This is Mike Perutka. He had 75 of them already functioning, and I think he picked up probably 25 or more simply from doing a few radio programs with us and by word of mouth from other groups that had done exactly the same thing. Well, did you actually get other people who are willing to begin doing some of these programs up there in the Spokane area?
Yes, we did. In fact, we've already started signing people up for our next class that we're going to be doing on the last Saturday in February and the first Saturday in March. And they can contact me if they would like to reserve some space for that. And I could give my number.
You go right ahead.
That is 509-891-7428.
Give that one more time.
509-891-7428.
And, of course, that's Neil Davis, and Neil has a business up there. But, of course, he spends an awful lot of time trying to get this message out across America. Now, you know, of course, what you hope, I would hope that some of the people in your first group will be able to start the sessions on their own. Even if only one or two of them do, you can gradually begin to get the message out. Because it's so vitally important that people really understand the secret of our Constitution, which has been actively suppressed for 50 years by those who would limit our freedom.
Dr. Stan, this course is really a wonderful class, especially for those of us who went through the public school system. It's incredibly enlightening. It's a good first step. It might be considered Constitution 101 or American History 101, all the things that were left out of our education. When I first went through it and saw the evidence for the truth, I just thought, boy, all those years in public school, and I didn't hear any of this. Kind of felt ripped off, actually. But, you know, what do you do? You start where you're at, and you go on from there doing what you know is right. And this particular class, we had some wonderful people in there, and there are a couple of different folks that are going to be putting these on. One gal is going to be doing it at her home and having a group there, and another fellow is talking to his church, and they're going to hopefully do it there. We don't have word for sure yet. And then there's a church up in Colville that is discussing doing it as a community service once a week for 12 weeks.
Well, I think that is really exciting, Neil. And, you know, this is sort of what I hope, and I hope we can have the same thing happening all across America. Now, you know, why don't you tell our listeners who puts on the program, how it's structured, and, of course, you know, because a lot of people are a little afraid to, you know, it's going to take a lot of time, a lot of effort on their part, but this is pretty well all laid out exactly how to go ahead and put the program on, and using videos with Dr. John Eidsmo. Why don't you tell our listeners how this whole system works?
Dr. John Eidsmo is a constitutional professor at Faulkner University, and he does this video program. It's 12 sessions. Each of them is a half an hour. And Michael Perutka and his brother were concerned about the issues of the day, and they looked for a program to educate themselves and some friends, and they came upon this video series. And to make it easier for folks like me, it's a little intimidating, especially I'm not a constitutional expert, but he put together a real nice package to host it. And so you're not necessarily the teacher. You host Dr. Eidsmo's presentation. And he's got it laid out here with some nice questions and notes, and it takes a lot of the intimidation away. So what I did was I got together with some folks from the Constitution Party, and we decided to put one on here at the Shiloh Inn. And you know, there was some preparation, of course, but you don't have to be, like I say, a lawyer or a constitutional attorney to do this. You can. I'm a tool maker by trade, and the fellow that co-hosted with me is a saddle maker. So the format of ours, we had about a half an hour of introduction and discussion on either pertinent events during the past week to what the lecture might be on, or maybe a little bit of questions from the week prior. And then we would watch the video, take a little break, then come back and go through some questions and answers. And then we had a time of discussion. And we held the class for an hour and a half. And we used every bit of the hour and a half. It was officially over at 8:30 although the doors stayed open till about 10. So,
well, you know, when people understand, you know, I was a graduate of the University of California, and I minored in history, and they took all these American government courses, you know, and I never learned any of these things. I was 32 years old before I even understood the difference between a Republican and a democracy. And I, like you, felt totally cheated that I'd gone to a major university. It's taken me a long time to understand the purpose of education in America is not to educate. It's to indoctrinate in totally false concepts and to conceal the truth from the people who go. And that's why, if we have any hope at all, it's going to be programs like yours starting right now to teach people in the Constitution. Now, we know that the FBI feels that you can tell a terrorist, one of the first things about a terrorist, he talks about the Constitution. If you don't believe that, go up on my webpage, and you'll actually see the pamphlet that was circulated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Phoenix back in 1999, when they knew they were actually investigating the Islamic terrorists, but they never listed them in the pamphlet they circulated to law enforcement and the general population. Oh, no. It was the people who talked about the Constitution and people who believed in the doomsday scenario, presumably Christians who believe in the coming of the Lord in the Day of Judgment. This was what they were putting out, and they said, you know, report this to your local FBI agent, and the numbers are there, and you can actually take down the numbers and call them, and you'll find out that the officers in the sheriff's office and elsewhere are very embarrassed, but they went right along with this. They didn't have the courage to say, you know, we took an oath when we entered law enforcement to uphold the Constitution, and we betrayed it when we put out this pamphlet. But you can be sure there's similar sorts of things on the minds of government officials all across the country. The major threat to the power structure is the Constitution of the United States. And if we don't know that Constitution, then we do not deserve to be free. So there was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm among the people here, Neil?
Absolutely. A great deal of enthusiasm. In fact, three of the folks are going to be working with us on a judicial review. We vote on our judges here in Washington, and it's really difficult to get accurate information on them. And there is an organization, Tandem Linsiter, that has put out a judicial review, and it's been just a small group, and the fellow that was doing it has actually moved out of state, and he's still been doing it on our behalf, and our desire is to put together half a dozen or a dozen qualified people. They're going to go through some additional training to learn how to review these cases and do some reporting to put some good information in people's hands.
Well, I hope maybe you'll get hold of Pastor Robbie Roberson up there, Robbie Roberson up in Wenatchee, because he's had a lot of experience with the judges there, and the total corruption within his city, and the total corruption not only of the judiciary, but of the churches there, who refuse to take a stand against corruption because they want to be politically correct. But, you know, of course, there are good judges, and he's actually had an opportunity to have dealings with some of them who were so infuriated by what was going on. But unfortunately, so many of them simply went along because that is the way to get along in this society. And he would be an excellent source of information, at least on some of the judges who he's had personal contacts with, the good and the bad. And I think that that is so important, too. If we have corrupt courts, it is partly because of the inaction of the people. We can be involved, but we have to care. I will tell you, the people on the other side are dedicated. They will work 20 hours a day, and they'll work weekends, because they're dedicated to controlling you. And go ahead.
Dr. Stan, I was talking to a fellow that was in a local city government position, and he said that he would contact the local conservative groups or Christian groups and see if they could not provide for him some help for different committees that he needed volunteers for. And sometimes he would get no one. Yet he could call the homosexuals, and they would provide as many as he needed. And that is certainly it should be shameful to the church.
Well, that's why the homosexuals are winning and why the Christians are losing, and they'll continue to lose unless they're willing to be involved. And I'm so glad that you're up there as a rallying point for people. And I hope when you actually begin these new programs that you'll give us a call, and we'll go ahead and make an announcement. Or you just call in on my program here in the evening and make an announcement, and, you know, just invite people to, you know, if these aren't some public place, probably people wouldn't want to necessarily to announce the ones over on the air where there's going to be held. Maybe they'd put their telephone number or something out, but whatever we can do to help you is so important, because what you're doing, I believe, is part of a movement that's spreading across America. And Barbara Walters and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw are not going to announce it because their establishment is frightened to death that the American people might wake up and begin to realize what's happening.
You know, Dr. Stan, what I saw the response in this class was a little bit of truth dispels so many lies. And these classes will affect a change in these people forever.
Right.
And even after the very first night, there was a woman that stood up and said, "What do we do?" And, you know, I don't have all the answers, but I think this is a good place to start.
It absolutely is. And, of course, from there, I hope you can get the people educated to understanding what the other side is doing, because the other side is very well organized. And, of course, so many of the conservative groups get you doing a lot of, you know, nonsensical things. You're busy being busy, but you never get anything accomplished. What they're really concerned is an effective group that it is really doing something and educating others, and then eventually, of course, knowing who the good candidates are and when they run for political office, doing everything they can to get them elected, and mobilizing the churches and finding the ministers who have the courage to take a stand and who have more fear of God than they do of their board of elders or than of the local government officials. So if you're out there in the listening audience up in the Great Northwest or anywhere in the country listening to this, well, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. So it sounds like you may have as many as, what, three or four new institutes on the Constitution starting up there now?
Yes, and then we're going to be doing one, it looks like, in the spring, south of Coeur d'Alene in a small town called St. Mary's, Idaho. Yeah. And at this point, we're just at the beginning stages of putting that together as well. So we're hoping to put on maybe as many between what I'm going to be involved with and other folks doing that have already gone through the course. We might be doing four or five.
Well, I think that's great, and this is just the beginning. And I will tell our listeners the same thing is happening all across America. But Neil is the one person I know working out this in the areas where we are, where we can actually help at least use the airwaves to let people know that this is actually going on. So why don't you tell our listeners what you've learned about the Constitution, why this is exciting to you?
Well, could I give you a little history, first of all?
Please do.
It was probably right around 91, and we were in much turmoil with our children in the public school system. And at the time, we were living in San Diego, and I really didn't know what to do. And my wife and I prayed about this for several months, and clearly the Lord showed us. And it's a long story. I'll give you the very short version. The same day, probably within about 5 minutes of one another, we both knew that we were to homeschool. And we were about 20 miles apart at the time, and I got home from work and was so excited to tell her, and she was concerned to what she had committed herself to do to one of the boys. And one of the boys said that he was very much in favor of that, and so she was concerned about when I got home and having to talk to me, and I was so excited. And anyway, it's just really been a wonderful, wonderful to be able to reflect upon the answer to prayer, and that being the starting point, really, for some major changes. And through homeschooling our kids, we started looking at some history and studying some of the biographies that my sons were reading, and these were elementary kids, but of great men in America's history and even in world history. And I started to see more and more that things were wrong. And one thing that we're accused of a lot today is we're accused of being negative and reactionary. And, you know, we need to be positive and have a well-thought-out plan and a strategy. And I think that if we learn what the truth is, first of all, in the Scripture, and then we learn what the law of our land is, that that is a good sound place to start. Proverbs 12:24 says, "The hand of the diligent shall bear rule, but the slothful shall be under tribute." And our forefathers were not slothful. They were diligent. The odds were against them. And we had our war for independence, and reading through the Declaration of Independence, and you know, it sets the ideals for our nation. And that was, what, 13 years prior to the Constitution?
Well, let's see, that was 76, that would be 86, 1787, so it was 11 years before the opening of the Constitutional Convention, and 13 years before the Constitution itself was signed. So that's 13 years. Okay, let's go to John calling in from Idaho. Hi, John, how are you?
Very good.
What part of Idaho are you in?
Post Falls. I took your advice, Dr. Stan, and I went down and attended that meeting at the Institute of the Constitution, the Shiloh Inn. It was wonderful.
Well, what do you think? Do you think it would be a better country if we had a million lawyers like Patrick Henry?
Oh, indeed it is. It would. And Michael Perutka is just the most marvelous wit. It's just wonderful to have the counsel of a godly man like that that is not only very solid constitutionally, but also very entertaining.
All right. So did you have this feeling of sort of enthusiasm there among the people that suddenly here's something we can do to begin to reclaim our Christian heritage?
Indeed, it's great to be on the offensive for change and not always being on the defensive and looking at all the wreckage that's being worked on the Constitution, but rather think about some positive things we can do. As the book of Hosea says, that my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, and there is a tremendous ignorance out there. I thought I knew some things about the Constitution. I had straight A's in high school, but I've learned quite a bit since going on Michael Perutka's website, and I would like to fit that IOC, not the International Olympic Committee, but the Institute on the Constitution program into my schedule.
All right. Well, I hope you'll either put one on, or you'll certainly get to somebody else's.
Yes.
You have a Neil Davis's telephone number now?
I do indeed. It was delightful to meet you there, Neil, and your young bucks.
Well, thank you.
And I also should mention, too, Stan, that at the meeting there, we had the highly esteemed former mayor of Spokane, John Talbot, showed up. I don't know how he heard about that. And also Rob Chase, who was a candidate, Libertarian candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 5th District, was also at that meeting.
Well, there has to be some
sort
of a...
He actually graduated from our class.
Oh, does that mean the mayor did?
No, Rob Chase.
Okay, fine. Well, that's great. And
but one of our students happens to be apparently a neighbor of the former mayor of Spokane, and they have shown some interest, and so I believe she's going to put that on at her home.
That's wonderful. Well, this is really what it takes to get started, and if you're listening out across America and you're interested in doing this, you give us a call and we'll put you in touch with Michael, and Michael doesn't get paid for this. Covers the expenses of putting together these programs, but he flies all over. He gives his time. He's investing a tremendous amount of his time and effort. They've actually started a classical college back there, which he is funding, and all the professors there. And, as a lawyer, he has the opportunity to make pretty good money, and he's investing all of this in trying to save America. And we had a lot more people like Michael and his brother, Stephen, who had put their shoulders behind this. And, of course, like Neil, who's totally dedicated to this concept of getting the information out. And more people across America are looking for something to do. This is where we have to begin. We have to know the foundations of our belief and the Christian concepts that were laid out in the Constitution. Why the Constitution was made as it was, and why it served us so well for so many years. Anything else you want to say, John?
Yeah, very quickly. There was no media there, but that's all right. We can do it with or without them. We can surprise the Liberals with candidates, and they won't even know what hit them. Michael Perica mentioned that there's already one that's been elected to the Delaware. It's either the Delaware or Connecticut.
No,
House.
It's right
Maryland,
there in Maryland.
Maryland House
right.
of Delegates.
There we go, Maryland, yes. And then also, as you said, Stan, our God is a God of miracles. And just look at, we have a new majority leader this week, and I rejoice in that. It's a little healing after the Clinton era when you think that Trent Lott presided over one of the great injustices of the 20th century. And that's it.
Okay, thanks so much, John.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming, John.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, you bet.
God bless. Okay, fine. If you're out there, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And if you might be interested in taking this on, if you'd like to know more about the Constitution, you know, when I get up in public and I say America was founded as a Christian nation, and everybody, oh, what a terrible thing to say. And yet, of course, the Supreme Court held repeatedly this is was a Christian nation. Certainly, even the Supreme Court starts its sessions every day with the choir comes in and says, God save the United States and this court. Well, if that happens at the Supreme Court, then why did the Supreme Court take God out of school? That's a tradition been going on for over 200 years. Why? Very simply, because they want to destroy the faith of our children. That's what it was all about. I mean, they know that they're not going to change the people in Congress and in the Senate and the older folks, but they want the souls of your children, and you don't want to let them have them.
You know, Dr. Stan, the lack of understanding of what form of government we have runs extremely deep. I was at a national park 2 years ago, and I was looking at some of the souvenirs, and they were talking about this great democracy. And these are souvenirs at a national park. And if you were to ask the average person on the street, even someone that did well in school, they'll tell you that we have a democracy, or something like that. I had opportunity to ride on an airplane with a professor of political science from Washington State University recently, and I asked him, what form of government do we have? And he pondered for a moment, and then he answered and said, that is a very difficult question to answer. And all I did was recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
And what was his response?
Well, he looked a little dumbfounded, but he talked about the evolving Constitution. It's a living document.
Where does it say that in the Constitution? Where does it say that? I mean, he sounds like like Al Gore, who says it's a living document. It never says that in the Constitution. In fact, if you go to the Justice Building down in the basement, inscribed in marble there, one of the pillars is this is a permanent document that cannot be changed except with great difficulty. That's why it was set up as it was. They didn't want to let men be able to change it, because once men can change the meaning of the Constitution, then we have ruled by man rather than ruled by law.
This evolving Constitution, though, that whole perception and the perception that we're a democracy is so destructive. People do not understand representative government, where our representative, whether it's to the state legislature or to Congress, they don't swear to uphold the wishes of the people. They swear to uphold the Constitution. And how are we to know if the man's doing a good job or not if we don't know and understand that, at least on a primary level?
Well, I think the tragedy is most of our elected officials don't understand the Constitution, or don't understand that they are limited in what they can do, because every one of our states is a republic. One of the stipulations was that every state be a republic and have a republican form of government, not a democracy, because our founding fathers feared democracy. And, of course, I'm sure you're well acquainted with the statement by James Madison. We'll get to that when we get back. But right now, we're going to have to take a three-minute break, and we'll be right back then with Neil Davis from the Spokane area. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there will decide right now that you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we reach out across America 5 hours a day with the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and as we, try to get people to understand the spiritual forces working to destroy the Christian heritage of this country. Why? Because, of course, there are people who worship the dark side, who worship the prince of this world, and their objective is to destroy Christian America, to destroy the people of this country, and to wreak terrible vengeance and hatred, because this is the first country in all recorded history where rights came from God, not from government. And this was a Christian country at one time. Everybody knew it was a Christian country. The media knew it was a Christian country. Even the Supreme Court knew it was a Christian country. And everyone acknowledged that there was a force, a power, a greater than the authority of the state. And, of course, the state had to respect that. And that force was our Creator. And that, of course, was commonly known. Every school child knew that for 150 years. That's no longer taught in our schools because, of course, what they really want is to simply merge us into this new world order and the new world religion. And, of course, the great enemy of the wicked people is a knowledgeable and informed American public. And our job is to reach out with this message and give people access to the people and to the organizations and to the literature which will lay out the truth about America and its Christian heritage and our form of government, a restricted government, where the chains were to be taken off of the people and put onto the politicians. Well, we've come a long way from that when we see the total awareness program being implemented by our military so that the military will know everything about every American citizen. What's that to do with fighting terrorism? Absolutely nothing. Now, the war on terrorism is not aimed at the terrorists. They've known the terrorists were here for years. They've known that we're being financed from the United States for years. They were watching and observing the terrorists for years. That's how, within 2 hours of the attack on the World Trade Center, the FBI could be at the restaurants where the terrorists ate, at the flight schools where they trained, in the neighborhoods where they lived. They knew ahead of time, but, of course, we had to have an incident to justify the frightening things that have happened since then, as we turn our back on our concept of limited government and in the names of attacking the wicked terrorists, why, of course, we take away the freedom of the American people. Well, you can join in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation under God can long endure. And give us a call if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, or if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters. Our September newsletter explains the attack a year ago. The October newsletter is Kristen Breitweiser's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the 18th of September of this year. The November letter deals with an overview of what's happening and, of course, an introduction to the monetary crisis, which will wipe out most of the people listening to this program if they do not take action right now to protect themselves. And my December newsletter will give you a great deal more detail about the impending financial crisis we face. And, of course, the war in Iraq with Iraq is simply one of the covers to keep your attention away from what's really important so that you will not move now while there might be time to at least be able to survive the coming difficult time. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Our website is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Please go there. Please tell others about our website. Tell them about our programs. It's up to you to be involved. And then, of course, to get others involved, listening, and, of course, if you can, to set up an Institute of the Constitution or attend one. And, of course, I get hold of Neil at 509-891-7428. It's exciting to know this is happening not just in Spokane, but all across America. And of course, Michael is setting up these new institutes all across the country, a growing number, a significant increase in the number since we've had Mike on our programs. And we're going to get him on all the rest of the programs as well, because this message needs to be heard from sea to shining sea. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Neil Davis. And Neil, of course, I've met on a number of occasions. He's totally dedicated, and you just need somebody to be willing to put in the time and effort to get these programs started. How much time does it really take you, Neil, to actually put this on every week?
You know, I've got some help, my wife and my son's help, and a couple of dear friends' help around here. But we probably only spend, including setup, tear down, and the preparation time before, maybe an hour and a half a week in preparation time. Now, if there's a large article, we've reviewed a few articles. We read the Humanist Manifesto, which we kind of contrasted a few things with. We went through with a pretty fine-tooth comb the Declaration of Independence and a wonderful article by Joseph Sobran, How Tyranny Came to America. Those took a little bit longer, but you know, it's really enjoyable study, and even then it wasn't more than a couple of hours preparation time. But you know, I read a little story to my sons several years ago, and it was called Spare Moments. And what are you doing with your spare moments? Are you watching television? Are you, where are you investing your time? And what is important to the future and to your posterity? You know, we can have the right opinions, but unless we're willing to act upon them, they're really useless.
Well, you know, Neil, we are so fortunate to have been born in America. I mean, people every place in the world strive for freedom. I mean, the original American Constitution was the envy of every other nation in the world. So many of them tried to imitate what we had here. But nobody really understood the basic fundamentals, that this country was a nation under God. And as de Tocqueville had said so well in 1840 in his book, Democracy in America, as I came to America to search for the cause of America's greatness and genius, I searched in the harbors and in the mines and the manufacturing and the halls of Congress and the matchless constitutions and the institutions of learning. But it wasn't until I went into the churches and found their pulpits flaming with righteousness that I realized the source of America's greatness. America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. Well, America has ceased to be good. We are today a pagan nation. Can it be reclaimed? I think we have to try, because the alternative is too horrible to contemplate. The total loss of all freedom and our possessions and perhaps the lives, not only our own lives, but those of our families. And if it happens, it will happen not because the other side was so intelligent or capable, because the apathy of indifference of the good people of America and of the silence of the pulpits today in the face of the growing evil.
Dr. Stan, we've left the field. We didn't show up for the battle.
Right.
And I was looking at Luke 12, 4 and 5 the other day, and I say unto you, my friends, be not afraid of them that kill the body, and after that have no more that they can do. But I will forewarn you whom you shall fear. Fear him which after he has killed has power to cast into hell. Yes, I say unto you, fear him. And we're so afraid of Al Gore. You know, we don't need to fear Al Gore. The Bible tells us that we're to fear God. We're to do what's right before him. Leave the results in his hands. We're to be diligent, good stewards with what he's put in our trust. And plow the road that's before us.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. I think, though, that we have an obligation to be involved. And I often think of that wonderful parable that Christ told about the Lord who went away. And, of course, the Lord who went away was himself. And, of course, he gave one of the servants 5 talents and 1 3 talents and 1 1 talent. And a talent was like a dollar or a measure of gold. And, of course, when the Lord returned, when Christ came back, he wanted to see what each person had done. And the one person who had the 5 talents had invested it wisely and doubled it. And the one who had the 3 talents had invested it wise and doubled it. But the one servant who had the 1 talent didn't do anything with it at all. he just buried it in the ground. And when the Lord came back, he said, well, I've kept it for you. And the Lord was furious with him. And the message of that story, that parable to me, is we are to be involved while we're here. The Lord has given us dominion over the world and the opportunity to have an effect. And the people who simply live, and do nothing, will, of course, face the wrath of God when he returns. And I fully believe that. I believe we are to be involved. And the message that, oh, you don't have to do anything, God's going to do everything, is in total contrast to that parable. And because, of course, God is not here. Oh, his influence is here. He could intervene tomorrow if he wanted to. But he's leaving it up to us. He left it up to his three servants, and two of them were involved. And one, like the vast majority of the American people today, did absolutely nothing, just waited for the Lord to return.
You know, Dr. Stan, there's such an opportunity before us, though. We were able in this class to share the gospel with a lot of people that may not have come into a church. And one nice thing about this video presentation, he gives a brief discussion on the difference between gospel and law. And he says, of course, gospel is of most importance, but in this lecture, we're going to look at law. And we studied the worldview of our founders so we could better understand what their intent was. It's important for us to know the original intent of the law of our land.
Absolutely. In fact, I wonder how many of our listeners out there know who Blackstone was. If you do know who Blackstone was, give us a call. And why is Blackstone so important to what we're talking about now? If you know, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But, you know, Neil, the tragedy is people do not understand even why the Constitution was written as it was, or why our founding fathers didn't want a democracy. Does Dr. Eidsmo cover that at all in his articles?
He does. But I have a little confession to make. I had to look up in my Webster's 1828 dictionary the difference between democracy and republic. I had to do that. I had heard that we were a republic, but I was hearing all the time from other sources we're a democracy. And, you know, republic is rule of law. It doesn't matter if you're a blue-collar worker, a sports hero, a politician, we're all held equally to that law. A democracy, however, is just a majority. So a lynch mob, of course, is an extreme case of democracy. But he does cover that. And he covers that law cannot save a man. What it can do is keep him from acting out upon his inner desires. He gives the example in this video series of walking by a jewelry store and seeing a nice piece of jewelry and only a piece of glass between him and that jewelry. And it's the law that would keep him from breaking that glass, picking out that piece of jewelry and running with it, because the fear of imprisonment. But the law itself does not keep him from having the thought. So,
no, but of course, his relationship with the Lord would keep him from having the thought, because, would keep him even from acting on it. Because, of course, you know, as John Adams said so well, our system of government was made for a moral and religious people. It wouldn't work for any other. What was he talking about? This concept of limited government and individual freedom. You can't be free unless you have a moral people. And if you have an immoral people, then you must have a dictator.
Absolutely.
Well, you know,
he goes into those issues of what a transformed heart and a renewed mind would do as far as sin goes. So he does discuss the gospel and its implication on man and sin.
Well, that's really wonderful approach for people who are not necessarily Christians, but at least they hear the logic of the Christian message, without perhaps the preaching that might go with it. But hopefully that would cause them to want to look further into the promises of the Christian faith.
It's a good open door for that to continue. In fact, and as you build relationships and people learn to trust one another, that creates more of an opportunity to share the truth of the gospel. And when they see that the forming of this country was primarily shaped by men who did fear the Lord, and they desired to do what was right before Him, it changes their perspective. We've heard so much about this, quote, law of separation of church and state, which, by the way, Eidsmo goes into the history of that as coming from a letter to the Danbury Baptists several years later after the ratification of the First Amendment. But people start seeing America in a different light after studying true history.
Well, you know, you commented earlier about the conversation with the professor of political science who really couldn't quite tell us what sort of government we had. But, you know, there's wonderful things that I read 40 years ago, or listened to 40 years ago, some of the talks. And I remember Dean Mannion. He was the dean of the Notre Dame Law School and a professor of law. And he said, you know, you can read the Declaration of Independence, and you can read the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Federalist Papers, and never once see the word democracy used, other than to decry it and say the last thing we want in America is a democracy. And then quoting James Madison, democracies are spectacles of turbulence and contention, are incompatible with personal security and private property, are usually as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. The last thing that he wanted was a democracy for America.
You know, Dr. Stan, I think we have a wonderful opportunity before us. A lot of people have asked me, you know, what's our chances of regaining a foothold? And the voter turnout is very low, but roughly 50% of eligible voters voted in the 2000 election. And I would say that a good number of those folks that voted plugged their nose and cast their ballot. And if we can raise up a small army of people that know the truth and that say, you are going to be taking an oath to uphold the Constitution, or in the case of a president, to protect and defend, I believe is the words. I might be wrong there. But if we have a group of people that understand the basic principles of our Constitution and that are not afraid to vote for the right candidate, maybe not the one that the Ted Turners of the world tell them will win, but the right candidate, I believe that God can bring us victory.
Well, of course, in the ultimate analysis, why it is God's battle, but He expects us to be involved. And he expects us to be doing the righteous thing when he does return, as in that parable that I cited earlier. And so, you know, certainly if there were 1,000 people in a congressional district, they could get a responsible person elected. But there has to be that hardcore of people who are really dedicated and are willing to commit themselves individually and personally. And if they can afford it, yes, put the money in. If they can't, then put the time in. But everybody can do one or the other. But they have to care enough about freedom and to understand that liberty and limited government at every level are synonymous, and that tyranny and total government are synonymous, and we are moving rapidly towards a dictatorship, in which was once the land of the free and the home of the brave, and it's happening under the name of fighting terrorism. And, of course, the tragedy is that the average American knows something's wrong, but he just can't put it all together. And he can't understand that really the spiritual forces that are at work in our society aimed at taking away our freedom as really almost an act of revenge against this nation, the first nation ever created as a truly Christian nation. So there is tremendous hatred for America and everything we stand for. And, of course, it permeates our universities, and the best thing we could do would be to close almost all of them down, any state-supported institution. If it could be closed down, the people would have an opportunity to learn the truth. They're certainly not going to get it going to the universities. And I don't know any university today, other than maybe a few very small private, either Catholic or Protestant strongly Protestant university, where the students are really going to be educated. The rest of them, they're going to be indoctrinated, and that's just what they're doing in our public schools today, which is why everybody who loves their children has to get their children out of government schools.
Dr. Stan, I see the homeschooling movement as being a wonderful thing for this nation. You know, what's coming out of that is some young men and women that fear God. They understand the Word. They understand history. For the most part, they're very literate.
And not only that, they can spell.
Yes. Homeschoolers have been winning spelling bees, geography bees, history bees, and you know, they're not always given the same shake when it comes to a job application. There's still a big segment of our society that hasn't really had much contact with them, but I see that as a great opportunity. And I know that it really transformed our home. And it really drew me even into more of the proper role as father, husband, in our home. So if anybody out there is contemplating it, I would sure encourage you to do a biblical study on education. See if the ungodly are supposed to be the teachers of your children.
And you know, the other thing is that, you know, if you see a child that has been homeschooled, they're an entirely a different attitude as far as their niceness, as far as their dress, as far as their ability to carry on an intelligent conversation.
There were several homeschooled kids in the class that we just did. And they were a delight to have in the class.
Right. Well, we've got Rob calling from Liberty Lake up in Washington. Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
Hi. So whereabouts is Liberty Lake?
Actually, it's just east of Spokane, about 2 miles from Idaho.
Okay, fine. I don't know that area very well, but I really should get up there one of these days. Maybe we'll put a meeting on up there one of the times. But anyway, did you have a question or comment?
Well, I just wanted to call and support Neil. I'm a graduate of his class. And I was really impressed with the whole thing up until a few years ago, when I'm 49 now. I really knew nothing about the Constitution. And, you know, the more I read about it, after I got a computer and started going on the Internet and reading the alternative press, I really realized a lot of what I had learned in public school or didn't learn. You know. But the country was in a lot of trouble, and, you know, we all have children, and we want them to have the same chances that we had. So I think, you know, being part of public office, running for public office, or being appointed to office, you know, is important for Christians to do. You know, you can go out there and actually make a difference, and, you know, you can be active in your church. But if you just do one of these other things, you know, if enough people do them, then you really can make a difference, because it doesn't take that many people to make a difference.
It really doesn't. There are not very many people on the other side. They're just dedicated.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it really occurred to me, if I had ancestors or family that faced bullets, you know, I was too young for the war, you know, and all that, but I can certainly face the press, you know, and, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Well, once you know what you're doing, you know, and you learn a few of the basic elements of just putting your points over, and don't let them twist your words or take your words out of context, you know, you have nothing to fear from that. And I hope if you keep listening to our program, you can pick up enough things that you'll be able to handle anybody in the press or any of the questions that will be raised by the people on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to say? Program and, you know, taking the class like Neil did, you know, if we can just kind of keep growing this out. I think a lot of the churches, you know, feel a bit queasy or, you know, when it comes to politics or getting involved politically, even though, you know, from the pulpit they may feel discouraged about the way the country's going. You know, it kind of has to become a part of that. I think in the, you know, the Patriots used to meet at the churches, and now it's almost like, you know, it's hard to get that as a forum.
Well, let's hope that you can. We're going to have to let you go, because we've got Gloria calling here from Spokane. But thanks so much for calling, Rob, and please keep listening and keep supporting Neil, and I hope you can get more of these groups going up there.
You bet.
Bye-bye. Okay, Bye. Hi, Gloria. How are you doing?
Well, hi. I just wanted to mention several of my friends had attended Neil's class, and boy, they wouldn't miss it for anything, and they would always talk about their Constitution class. And I just wanted to mention one thing. You were talking about the difference between a republic and a democracy, and I was listening to focus on the family, and Dr. Dobson, bless his heart, knows a lot, but he does not know the difference between a democracy and a republic. So I immediately grabbed my official definition of a democracy, and it was written by the U.S. War Department November 30th, 1928. And it, their citizen training manual. Have you seen that, Neil?
Yes.
I read one out of a military training manual.
That's what this basically is. It's a war training manual by the U.S. government in 1928. And they had the official definition of the difference between the two. And so I immediately, you know, called his organization and faxed it, not to be rude, but just to let him know that when we pledge allegiance to the flag, we pledge to the republic. And we have to define our terms, and we have to keep calling it a republic because it's so oftentimes misnamed a democracy. And so, and I do appreciate people like you that take the time to inform people of all the information that we really need to know about the Constitution. So thanks for, you know, that course, and let us know when the next one's going to be happening.
All right, and we'll announce it here, or you can, Neil, you be sure to call in and during the program, and we'll just give you a free public service announcement.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan.
Okay, anything else, Gloria?
One other thing I wanted to ask, Neil, did you happen to see, there was a presentation by the Washington Association of Prosecuting Attorneys lecture in 1999, it was called Freeman, Armageddon's Prophets of Hate and Terror.
I did not.
Did you happen to see that document? A friend sent it to me when she was trying to get people to have the write-in candidate, Steve Alexander. Not that he's connected with this organization, but she was trying to promote him. And this organization by the prosecuting attorneys, they actually named different people that they consider prophets of hate, and one of them is, which was very upsetting, is people, it says constitutionalists, they put them in the same category as neo-Nazis, and I thought that was a great disservice.
I think that tells you a lot about the prosecuting attorneys. The constitutionalists, they've sworn to uphold the Constitution. They are, of course, extensions of the court, and if they believe people who support the Constitution are the enemies, then what are they?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, thanks so much, Gloria. We're out of time. God bless you. And Neil, I want to thank you so much for everything you're doing up there. And please let us know when these programs are going to start. And if you'd like to advertise or just put the word out, why, please let us know, okay?
I will, Dr. Stan. And thank you so much.
Good night. God bless you. And this is the time when we have to say goodbye to our listeners up there in the great Northwest. And, of course, we'll be back with you on Monday. Until then, pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until Monday, then, may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the few minutes because we have with us Joel Skousen, and Joel was with us earlier today. But Joel, I want you to know this is an entirely different audience. Nobody listening earlier is going to be listening tonight, because that program we were on earlier was the Genesis Communication Program with Shortwave Across America and stations I know back in Rochester and Tennessee, and the internet connections. But I don't think anybody locally heard what you said earlier. But maybe you want to talk about some different things. I saw that I just saw that you have a new World Affairs brief out. So what are we going to talk about this evening?
Well, I think it would be good to discuss, have an in-depth discussion on why the rush to war. This is an interesting subject because everyone is feeling it. The Bush administration is on some kind of desperate timetable to attack Iraq, and it's very, very difficult to figure out what's the agenda behind that timetable.
All right. I think that's a very, very good question, and I agree with you totally. There is this sense of urgency. Of course, part of that supposedly is the weather, in case, this was to drag on for too long. You certainly wouldn't want to be fighting in Iraq in the middle of the summer. But what is your take on why are they so anxious to get into the war as quickly as possible? Why don't we want to find out if they really do have weapons of mass destruction? And my feeling is, and especially as I read some of the editorials in the newspaper, and they say, well, we may not be able to prove that they have the weapons of mass destruction, but boy, after we get in there, we've taken over the country, we'll be able to find them. What happens if we got in there and there aren't any nuclear weapons? What happens if they really did destroy their biological and chemical weapons? Then what do you say after all the people are dead? Or maybe you really aren't worried about all the people who are dead. So what's this really all about, in your opinion, Joel?
Well, I don't think there's much chance of them not finding something. Any nation, sovereign nation, really has the right to develop weapons of mass destruction, just as the United States has the right to develop them. Obviously, to use them, you need to have the right of that's associated with defensive liberty. And they certainly don't qualify, but neither do we in this case. We're not doing this to defend liberty. We're doing this to intervene and to follow another agenda, which is very obvious. If we were really defending liberty, we'd be much more concerned about North Korea, which has medium range and is developing long range missiles. We'd be much more concerned about China, which has long range missiles. They have even received the SS-27 Topol M's from Russia. Russia claims to only have one battery of Topol M's, but if they're exporting to China, you know darn well that they've got a lot more of that in their own stockpile. So these were the real dangerous countries. Iran, for example, is much more dangerous than Iraq in terms of the development of its nuclear weapons program, biological and chemical weapons, and there's virtually no pressure on these countries right now. Now, it's true that Bush claims that these are on future hit lists, but there's got to be another reason of why the rush to attack Iraq. You know, this weapons inspector...
conflict.
A conflict that's going on in the UN is very, very telling. The U.S. exposes its position more and more each day as it twists arms in a dramatic way, almost a frenetic way, attempting to get its way with the UN. Bush made the mistake of all of this with the UN started with the fact that Bush was not intending to ask permission either of Congress or the UN. But he made a slip of the tongue in one of his news conferences where he said that he would be asking approval of, where he meant to say support from Congress and the UN. And because of that, his feet kind of have been held to the fire. been forced to go into all of this feigning, at least, support of getting a UN resolution, which he did, but they had to do a tremendous amount of arm twisting. Then they had to accede to weapons inspectors going in. And the Europeans, who were very much controlled under the table by Moscow still, are attempting to help Iraq out as much as possible. These inspectors are taking their time. They're being very careful to give a little bit of advance notice to Iraq so they can shuffle things around. I clearly think that Iraq has minor to moderate amounts of weapons of mass destruction. We know that they have fairly significant stockpiles of biological and chemical weapons. It's very, very doubtful that they've got any nuclear weapons. Even the defectors have claimed that he was close, but that they don't have any there. And he's really got limited launch vehicles in terms of chemical and biological weapons. He's maybe got a dozen Scuds left over hidden around, and they can do some damage, certainly. But it's very difficult to get widespread dispersion of chemical and biological agents with just a dozen Scuds. So really, this is a very limited threat, certainly no direct threat to the United States. It is a threat to Israel. But there is a massive steamroller of almost fanatic, time-driven desire to go to war. Bush is actually pushing the preparations as if the UN things don't matter at all. I mean, there's massive movements of troops. He's just called up 100, or given secret call-ups, standby alert to 127,000 Marines, who they've said are going.
Now, are these already in the Marine Corps? Are they?
These are active duty, not
okay,
reserves.
Okay.
Called up another 27,000 reservists, activated or put on standby 50,000 Army troops. And that is in addition to the almost 100,000 troops that he has in the area. So clearly Bush is going to war. There's no doubt about that. The big question is why the push that it has to be now? You spoke about you don't want this to drag into summer. In reality, this is summertime down there. January is and February are the extreme heat conditions. It's obvious that they're pushing to get this thing started despite the heat. They're certainly not going to avoid it by waiting.
So why are they doing it?
Well, it's interesting that, as we contemplate why, certainly I think the appearance of conciliation, even though they've declared Iraq in material breach, which is the technical name for default in this particular resolution, the United States is not pushing it. Obviously, the Europeans want to have inspectors go in and verify the U.S. Discrepancies that they claim are there in the report. So I think, in the first place, even though there is a time-driven attack schedule, it's obviously not right now, because I think the U.S. wants three carrier task forces on station before hostilities begin. We have the USS Washington off the Israeli coast. The USS Lincoln is in the Arabian Sea just outside the Gulf, and the U.S. is still waiting for the SS Harry Truman to get there. But it appears that what may be happening here in terms of a timetable, and I take this in coordination with the Rumsfeld dramatic announcement that ABM deployment is moving ahead, even though there hasn't been a successful testing of the system. This is very telling, that you're pushing an ABM system forward without testing, which has never, if rarely, been done, except in extreme war conditions when they know that war is just around the corner. It may well be that this agenda that we've talked about on your program before, the agenda to start a third world war, that this may well be the trigger for that, and that they know that they need an ABM system in place because they expect some retaliation. And I don't think it's from Saddam Hussein. He certainly can't reach the United States from these missiles. But the United States knows very well that Russia is the major ally of the Islamic nations, including Saddam Hussein, despite them being on board our so-called war on terror. And China serves as a surrogate to Russia in that regard. They're into Iran, also into Iraq, Cuba, Venezuela. China is playing cover for Russia, meaning they're playing the supplier of need so that Russia doesn't have to be caught doing it. But Russia's clearly intending to pull off a preemptive nuclear strike against America. And this is what makes it very interesting about the fact that the United States has come forward with this preemptive strike doctrine. And the Russians have said, well, gee, that's great. We can use that too. And the Chinese have said, yes, we might use that too. It's almost as if the United States is handing to Russia and China the excuse to attack America because it's become the bully of the world. And certainly this attack on Iraq is going to put the nail in our coffin in terms of international confidence in the U.S. as a real team player. It's very obvious to all the nations that we are the antagonist here, that we're pushing this without justifiable reason, that we'd have much more reason to go into North Korea and Iran than Iraq, but for some reason there's a fetish about going into Iraq. Specifically, I think that one of the main reasons is that if they do face a World War III scenario, and they know that Russia is going to be the main protagonist, they're the only ones capable of taking down the U.S. military in a preemptive nuclear strike. You know, China could hit Los Angeles and a few other places in Hawaii, but it wouldn't be enough to take out the 3,000-some-odd targets, military targets, necessary to disable the U.S. military. Russia has that full capability right now. But if the U.S. knows that they're trying to get the U.S. into a third world war for global purposes, to engender a new world order, they've got to be very concerned about the potential of oil supplies being cut off. So Iraq may be an essential one for two purposes. One, to continue to rattle the cages of the world, to make the U.S. look like the bully of the world, to induce Russia to pull off a preemptive strike. And two, to make sure that the western side of the forces has a major oil supply in case OPEC, which is primarily aligned with the Soviet Union, or the continuing Soviets, especially since Venezuela is under the control of a Marxist communist right now, they may want to tackle and take on Iraqi's oil fields. It's also very interesting that Iraq doesn't appear to be prepping for this war in a way that is survivable, almost as if they're going to give in very easy and do the wrong thing. They could easily carry this war on to a guerrilla nature by disbanding their troop movements out in the open, go into Baghdad and fight a guerrilla war, which would cost Americans thousands and thousands of casualties, as well as create a lot of discontent around the world. So I suspect that there is a much larger regional, if not world war, agenda that's driving this. There seems to be a timetable involved in pushing this forward. You know, you and I have discussed that there are most likely Luciferian controls in this New World Order scenario, and these people have made their pacts with the devil, if you will, and he may well be dictating timing terms for reasons that none of us know.
Well, you know, it's really very disconcerting when I read a poll the other day that over 50% of the American people would not object to our preemptive use of nuclear weapons, assuming Saddam Hussein were to use chemical or biological weapons against our troops. You know, and I thought, you know, what a terrible, terrible, terrifying thing that would be. The callous indifference to, you know, on the part of our American people to the terrible suffering and horror of the use of nuclear weapons on the civilians of Iraq. And I wondered if they perhaps reworded that question and said, would you be willing to use a preemptive nuclear strike on civilians in Iraq if you knew that it might engender a nuclear strike on the cities of America? I wonder how many Americans then would be willing, of course, to go along with that. But once we've established the precedent, how could we object to nuclear weapons striking America? Men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose, and it seems that the American people have totally forgot about the concept of evil, and that we are responsible for what our government does. And if they see nothing wrong with using nuclear weapons on the Iraqi people, what possible reason would they have to object to the use of nuclear weapons on themselves and their families? This is frightening because of the callous indifference of the American people.
You know, that's very true. The Americans have been sold a bill of goods, even concerning our first use of nuclear weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, we've been told this was necessary in order to save millions of troops having to invade Japan. But, you know, Americans take simplistic reasons that they're given and really don't challenge them or think them through very well. If you think it through, you can say, now, wouldn't it have been just as effective as a demonstration of power to the Japanese if we had dropped an atom bomb onto one of the islands outside of Tokyo Bay, which was a military island or an industrial reserve where there weren't a lot of civilians, to give a demonstration of power? And wouldn't that have had the same effect? And it certainly would have. There was no need, absolutely, to drop those two bombs on civilians.
Not only that, but the Japanese have been trying to surrender for 6 months, and we wouldn't let them. And we have the clipping out of the Chicago Tribune on the day that the peace treaty was signed on the Missouri, making that statement.
That's correct. In fact, the Germans were trying to surrender a year in advance of that, and neither Churchill or Roosevelt would hear of it. They wanted unconditional surrender, meaning no terms, that you had to be beat to the dust. And that's why, of course, the reason that they were doing it is because they had ulterior motives and agendas. And it wasn't to liberate Germany or France or any other country. It was to make sure that Stalin, they had a pact with Stalin, that he would get half of Europe. And they wanted to make sure that he had gotten through into Europe before they called for a ceasefire. They also devastated city after city of German civilians. And a lot of Americans and British think, well, that was in retaliation for the London bombing. But it wasn't. In fact, when we look at a close reading in the war, it was Churchill himself who first firebombed three German cities using incendiaries, targeting directly civilians, not industrial targets, that led Hitler, and we have his diaries, we have the journals of his people around him stating how he was always attempting and thought that he was going to make peace with England, and was reluctant to attack, especially civilians, and only attacked civilians once Churchill had provoked him into doing so. Now, in saying this, I'm not saying that Hitler was a kindly person, not at all, but he did abide by the Geneva Convention, the rules of war, until the Allies specifically went out to provoke him breaking through the rules of the Geneva Convention and bombing civilians.
Yes, I have a book that quotes, written actually by de Gaulle, or refers to a book by de Gaulle, who was visiting Churchill, and Churchill saw the German, I guess he went outside and he shook his face at the sky and said, "When are you going to come and bomb London? When are you going to come and bomb London?" You know, and de Gaulle said, "Are you so anxious to see your people killed?" And Churchill's response was, "Well, Roosevelt has promised me that once they bomb London, then of course he will come into the war." And of course Churchill wanted the Germans to bomb and kill English civilians because he thought that that would force America into the war. No concern at all for his own people any more than for the innocent civilians in Germany, who of course were victims of our bombing.
I used to be a real fan of Churchill. I never was a fan of FDR. I knew he was a phony and a socialist, but now as I've read deeper into history, I've found out that Churchill was never for the free market. He was never for real liberty. He was a globalist. He had designs, world designs, on this globalist pact, was in it with Roosevelt, knew about Pearl Harbor as well as Roosevelt did, knew that Roosevelt was provoking the Japanese into an attack, looked forward to it, knew that it was the thing that Roosevelt was using to get the U.S. into war. There were so many evil things that our Allied leaders did in those wars, and there are so many evil things that our leaders are doing now to get us into a World War III, and America is even more oblivious to it today than they were in World War II.
Well, you know, the Churchill's involvement in that invasion in during the First World War, the invasion of Turkey, there were, I think almost 150,000 British fell, and 100,000 French, or maybe it was 250,000 British. You know, it was a totally senseless invasion, in an area where there was no opportunity to make a breakout. All it could do would be to kill an awful lot of people. And Churchill insisted on that.
It was a terrible disaster.
Right.
Well.
And you wonder why. In fact, I remember talking to General Albert Wedemeyer, who was chief of planning for the American forces during the Second World War, prior to the war. And he said he never understood that invasion. It just didn't make any logical sense from a military point of view. And yet, of course, Churchill insisted on it. And looking back, and of course, Churchill did the same thing during the Second World War, insisted on the invasion of North Africa, no justification at all for it. And it was simply an effort to kill as many people as he possibly could, invade Italy, but never go after the soft underbelly of Europe, go into Marseille, unguarded ports, never try to end the war, prolong it. And, of course, the First World War invasion was at Gallipoli. And, of course...
That's what it was, yes, Gallipoli.
Right. And of
Great
course,
disaster.
And, of course, the British public knew it, and that's why they hated Churchill until the Second World War, until the media... began to build him up as a great hero. But Churchill was a druid, and that's what most people don't understand. He himself was deeply involved in the occult and with secret movements and secret societies, and I even leave a letter that he wrote to, a copy of a letter he wrote to H.G. Wells saying, well, I can't discuss that with you. I can only discuss it within the secret circle. So, I mean, there's much about Churchill that people don't know. A brilliant individual, but a very, very wicked man.
Yes, he really was. You know, a lot of I've found out in the private journals that I've read of people who are around Hitler that he quite frequently, not just infrequently, but quite frequently would call people into his private room for business and other military briefings and things when he was either stark nude or just in some form of underclothing and parade around and tell him, don't bother me, you know, I'm just... But, you know, you have to be very insensitive to the promptings of conscience, very insensitive to the spiritual side of life, to not have, the courtesy, you know, to get your clothes on and to not parade around before other men in those situations. So that's very indicative that this was not a good man.
Amen to that. Well, anyway, there's no question we're going to war with Iraq. There seems to be an urgency about it, and I share your concern about this fact that we're suddenly talking about putting in anti-missile defense. And of course, we have never yet, we have no consistency at all, hitting a bullet with a bullet. Of course, our leaders know how to make weapons that will work. We had in 1970 when we had our anti-ballistic missile system active. The Russians had one in 1970 that would work. And now we can't build one today. You know, it's amazing how gullible the American people are. People have forgotten we had deployed an anti-missile system back in the early 1970s. We actually took it apart in the... I think about 1977 under Jimmy Carter, because it was just too expensive to maintain after investing I don't know how many tens of billions of dollars building it, and then we spent tens of billion dollars dismantling an effective anti-ballistic missile system to leave us totally helpless in the face of a potential onslaught. But now suddenly, as you point out, there was an urgency of rebuilding it, and they know how to build a system that'll work, and they're specifically giving everybody in the world the idea we don't know how.
Well, it's interesting that even though they have repudiated the very flawed 1972 ABM treaty, I find it incredible that President Bush revealed to the American public that there was an escape clause in that. And they kept telling us for, ever since, every conservative has always been trying to get the U.S. to get out of the treaty and defend ourselves with an ABM system, all during the Star Wars proposals of Reagan that kept saying, we can't do this, it's a violation of the 1972 treaty. And then all of a sudden Bush announces, well, by the way, there's an escape clause within 6 months' notice. You can tell the other side you want out, and they have to let you out. They never told us that.
Yeah, it was really very interesting reading the editorial in the New York Times this week. They were deploring the fact that they were going to build an anti-ballistic missile system, and they said, what is the urgency? Maybe what we need is more testing and study. They've been saying that since 1982 or 83 when Ronald Reagan suggested this thing. They've been saying the same thing for 20 years. Oh, let's not rush into this. And here we are on the brink, possibly even of a nuclear war. And the New York Times has said, don't build a defense for America. Let's test it some more.
Well, it's interesting that even though the treaty has been scrapped, which had all kinds of restrictions upon limitations that you had to put on any ABM system that was allowed under the treaty, which was 100 interceptors, which we never built, by the way. You know, Russia kept at least 100, even though their other anti-aircraft systems could double as anti-missile systems. But in any case, you think that as soon as we'd scrapped the treaty that we would redesign our missile systems so that those same limitations that had been on, there were speed limitations, there were limitations that the U.S. put on them so that they couldn't use a satellite direction. They had to have their own onboard radar to be able to locate those warheads. It's much, much more efficient to use the satellites that are much closer to the warheads at their apogee when the MIRV warheads separate to have them track the warheads and guide the missile to it. But that's not part of any of our missile systems, either the Patriot theater weapons or the ABM system. And, of course, as you mentioned, there's no warhead on this ABM system. A warhead increases the kill ratio by at least 10 times. It's cheap. It's easy to put on. The Russians have nuclear warheads on there, so they can get in within a mile and still destroy incoming missiles. So it's very interesting that the Bush administration insists on maintaining these technical restrictions on its land-based and theater-based ABMs, even though the treaty isn't there anymore.
But of course there has to be a reason for it. And are they really certainly inviting a nuclear attack intentionally? That's the question I think that you raise so well, because nothing else makes any sense.
Well, what's interesting is we have to ask ourselves, if they're inviting a nuclear attack, and I mean, look at the SALT treaty, just agreement just signed between Putin and Bush this year, which basically meant there was going to be strategic arms reductions. The U.S. agreed to take out their MX early in 2003, and the Russians agreed to take out the rest of their SS-18s and some of their 23s, which would leave primarily the Topol-Ms, very, very powerful sixth-generation maneuvering warheads. In fact, they've even got a scramjet apparently on a warhead now so that it can really maneuver and maneuver any of the ABM system that we have. But nevertheless, the Russians just 2 months ago said, oh, by the way, we've decided that we're not going to dismantle any of our SS-18s. We need them for strategic purposes, especially since you're going to build an ABM system. So in other words, they scrapped the SALT agreement, and lo and behold, the U.S. says, well, we'll still honor ours. We'll continue to dismantle our MX, which is our most powerful set of missiles with 10 very large, powerful MIRV warheads on it. So that doesn't make any sense. That the U.S. continues to disarm, unless you buy into the theory, as I've proposed, that the U.S. is actually attempting to set us up so that the United States military is taken down in a World War III preemptive nuclear strike. And we ask ourselves, why would American leaders want to do that, especially since they're wealthy, this is the engine of all their wealth and their creation, why would they do this to themselves? I think we have to understand that they pretend to have American interests at heart. They speak as if they do, but in reality they act only as if global interests are at heart. And if you really want a global world government, you'll realize that the primary objection from all the other nations is, why should we put many, many millions and billions of dollars into arming the UN when the U.S. is the policeman of the world? And that provides the prime motive, in my estimation, of why they're intending to induce a nuclear preemptive strike on America, to remove us as the policeman of the world, thus forcing the world in great discouragement after absorbing a nuclear first strike to have to come out of the ashes of that. And believe me, it is survivable. This thing about the whole world going up in smoke and no one living through this is simply not true. The Russians know you can survive a nuclear war. They are preparing to it. It never has been a mad scenario, mutually assured destruction. It's only been U.S.-assured destruction because the Soviets have prepared with massive bunkers to survive a nuclear exchange, and we have no preparation except for our leaders.
I understand they're building now a bunker for Dick Cheney, and there have been reports of explosions there, in the area where Dick Cheney lives, adjacent to the National Observatory. It's been reported by Charles Lodgood. We have an article. I know people who know people who live in the area. Obviously, they're blasting a shelter for Dick Cheney, but not for the rest of the people.
You know, it'd be one thing to say, you know, you're on your own, there really is a threat, you ought to prepare, we can't afford to give you any tax money. But they aren't even doing that. They aren't whispering that American people ought to prepare for anything.
We're going to be back here in just a moment with Radio Liberty and our special guest, Joel Skousen. We'll invite your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent on those of you out there who listen to our programs, who recognize there is a problem and you'd like to become part of our team as we try to awaken the American people to the fact that there is a problem. We're trying to get at least the listeners to our programs to begin to make preparations for their survival from the physical point of view, with putting in food supplies and medical supplies financially so that they are not totally wiped out by the coming economic chaos, and then of course spiritually, because none of us get through with what lies ahead without our firm reliance upon the Lord. So our plea is, help us if you can possibly, as we reach out across America 5 hours every day by radio, by shortwave, by satellite, by internet, and you can certainly join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and get our four best tapes of the month and our monthly newsletter. You can certainly tell others about our radio programs. You can subscribe to our newsletter. You can go to our website. Tell others about our website at radioliberty.com. Copy our newsletters. Copy our audio tapes. And try to get people to listen to them. If you find something you think that will have an impact on somebody else, maybe a mother, or tapes on fluoridation, when they realize that they're poisoning the minds of her children, or topics on aspartame, on MSG, but specifically aspartame, which is the additive in our diet drinks, and it has a terrible, terrible effect on the brains of children, and so many of the children involved in these terrible atrocities and killings, and they do PET scans on their brains and their parts, and the frontal lobes that just don't work. And, of course, this is where many of these drugs actually attack our emotional system. They know, for instance, that you give fluoride to developing rats and rodents, and they become sort of couch potatoes, like so many Americans are today. We'd rather sit at home and watch television than go out and go hunting or go out and go doing anything of a physical nature. We've got real problems today. America is indeed is under attack, not only from without, but from within. So whatever it would be that you think would touch somebody's heart to make them realize there's a problem, why, give us a program, and we would love to have you duplicate everything we have and help us to get the word out across America. So again, our number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is at war. America truly is under siege today. Well, there's Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest Joel Skousen. Joel, before we go on, let's tell our listeners how they can get access to your material.
Well, I write the World Affairs Brief, a weekly news analysis service that comes by email, or there is a print edition for those that don't have access to the net. That comes out each month. It's a compilation of the four or five weekly briefs printed and typeset and sent out. You can find out about that on my website, www.joelskousen.com, J-O-E-L-S-K-O-U-S-E-N, joelskousen.com. And if you don't have access to the web, you can call my office at area code 801-224-4746 and request sample copies of the printed edition of the World Affairs Brief, and we can send out one of those that we've talked about tonight or any of the others.
All right. Well, now, of course, my producer just asked if I would ask you if you'd want to say anything at all about the economy.
Yes. The economy, I believe, is on what they call a shoulder. It's sloping downward, but it really hasn't gone off the edge of the shoulder into a precipitous fall yet. And I think that it may well do that during the after this coming year.
You mean after the first year?
Well,
are you looking at 2004?
I'm saying they are still showing all signs that they're intervening in the economy regularly in order to keep it propped up. believe me, they have a lot of ability to inflate still. They have been using inflation in a moderate way for many years, and the international economy has been absorbing those inflated dollars because the dollar is such a in demand for international trade. But it is saturated now. The dollar is falling. That means that the U.S. cannot flood the world market with any more dollars without it coming to home as inflation. But there certainly is room to do that. You know, that is the only mechanism the government has. Their periodic interventions in the futures market, they buy S&P futures through what they call the Plunge Protection Team, which is a coalition of about five Wall Street firms like Solomon Smith Barney and others that have the ability and have an unlimited account, with nearly unlimited account with the Feds to make these high-profile bets on the market, which drive the price up. And, of course, the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones are the ones that they target so that the rest of the market thinks everything's going up. But it's very selective. Most other stocks do not respond as the wild rides that the Dow has seen in the past 2 months. And that's because they're intervening and speculating in those rather than being a real market reaction to reports. In any case, it's my estimation that the second leg of this bubble is going to break after this, sometime during this coming year, and I really expect it'll be more toward the fall, and that is the real estate bubble. The real estate is already getting soft. Buyers are hard to come by now, and so I expect the market to start down. The trouble is that there's so much debt involved in the real estate market. Most people have refinanced under the lure of low interest rates, and because of that, the market can very quickly go below what they owe on their houses, and then they simply are in a position where they can't sell. It only pays to default. Defaults on mortgages and foreclosures are rising dramatically, as are personal bankruptcies. So all of this has a cumulative effect. It has a negative multiplier effect. That means that just as when you pump money into an inflation, it starts circulating faster and faster. When you start withdrawing money from the economy through job loss, through lack of speculation and spending, it starts to have a negative multiplier effect, and it's accelerating, frankly.
All right, so you're not optimistic then. You're not suggesting people be speculating in the market at the present time.
No, I'm. My recommendation is that people be out of the paper markets whatsoever. They ought to be getting more into a cash position. If they have investments, they ought to first and foremost attempt to pay off their mortgage. I think when you look at the potential of what taking money out of a 401k, for example, and taking the tax penalty, you know, you may lose 10% plus, you know, pay some taxes. But when you look at the potential market loss of those pension funds if they're in stocks and bonds compared to what would happen if you paid off a mortgage, paying off the mortgage is really the better thing to do. I know people, for example, who a year ago had enough money in their retirement accounts and there are other investments to clean out their mortgage completely. Now those investments are down 50%, and some of them have lost their jobs and can't pay their mortgage and are going to lose their house. So I can't emphasize enough how it pays to accelerate mortgage principal payments, even if you can't pay it off. Get that down as much as you can, and really stop spending in the way that most people around us are spending. I mean, everyone is still going into debt. Christmas sales are very strong still, but I think a lot of that's going to stop pretty soon.
All right. Now, what about Venezuela? Do you have any thoughts on that and what's going on down there?
Yes, Venezuela is a very sad case. What's really interesting or sad is that in the news media, you almost never hear. In fact, in the past 2 weeks, I have never heard one commentator. In the first place, most people aren't even discussing Venezuela, but it is prominent on national public radio. Not once have they ever mentioned that Chavez is a communist. They haven't even mentioned that he's, the more moderate word they use is Marxist, haven't mentioned that. They've never mentioned that he's giving precedent in any oil that does get shipped out through the blockade, through the general strike, to Cuba. The first tanker full of diesel fuel that he freed up at gunpoint from the suppliers in the oil strike he sent to Castro. He's also involved in helping out the FARC communist guerrillas in Colombia and Peru and other places. So this is a real Fidel Castro-type individual. And yet the media is treating him as if this is an unconstitutional opposition to a democratically elected leader. Now, he may well have been democratically elected. Venezuela is a very socialist country. They've got a lot of social welfare benefits, a benefit-corrupted electorate. Sure, they're going to elect someone who promises in the world he hasn't delivered. So he's embittered a lot of his own supporters. But nevertheless, even if he were democratically elected, he is acting in full tyranny now, denying civil rights, arresting opposition leaders. He's had his own minions kill numerous people as they've protested. He's at gunpoint forced business owners to stay open and not join the general strike. He packed the Supreme Court with 9 out of the 11 members so that they generally do what he wants.
Sounds like FDR.
Yes, exactly. He just, for example, the Supreme Court ruled that the oil refiners have to go back to work. Right now they're in defiance of this. Organization of American States, which is the conglomeration, like the mini UN of America, representatives of all the countries in America, especially Latin American countries, just voted to sustain the democratically elected Chavez. Everyone on the left is applauding this, showing that, you know, what's interesting is people on the left think that everything the U.S. does has to be evil because most of the time they do. Occasionally the U.S. does the right thing, like when they intervened with Allende in Chile, who was another communist revolutionary who gained power democratically and then was going to engage in a bloodbath, eliminating over 300 of the best and brightest right-wing military soldiers, as well as American missionaries, fundamentalist Christian missionaries, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, all of those were scheduled for liquidation. And if it hadn't been for the U.S. Encouraging General Pinochet to intervene and take him out, we would have had a bloodbath. Same thing's going to happen eventually in Venezuela. But the U.S. is very reluctant and is not intervening here, so it's pretty hard to call. They're just being extremely ambivalent about what they're doing. So right now, the opposition is not going to win as long as Chavez has military and police control. They simply cannot stand up against the guns. Whoever has the guns has the power.
Well, I think it was Chairman Mao said the political power comes out of the muzzle of a gun. And, of course, I know Chavez will certainly rig the elections, exactly as the man we put in power in Rhodesia has done, Mugabe. And people don't understand. We've helped these Marxists to come to power in country after country after country. I don't know what part we played in Chavez's getting to power. We do know, of course, that Chavez has always been close to Fidel Castro. And, you know, I find it very difficult to believe we didn't have something, some way to do with his ascending power. Certainly, we brought Fidel Castro to power. People have forgotten that. I talked to the American ambassador to Cuba at the time, a man named Earl C. Smith, and he told me he was instructed by our State Department to tell Batista, you will leave tomorrow. And the inference being, if you don't leave tomorrow, you'll get killed. But
and even before then, the State Department made sure that all military aid and assistance, all ammunition supplies were cut off to Batista so he couldn't fight Castro. Then we also find out that the CIA clandestinely sent ammunition to Castro. So they were directly aiding Castro. Right. At the same time, they mounted a huge propaganda campaign through Herbert Matthews and others. Drew Pearson in against Batista made Castro look like a mild-mannered reformer. This was not just accidental. I think there was a real, has been an agenda ever since the World War II, especially when it started with the betrayal of Chiang Kai-shek and the allowance of Mao Zedong to win over in China, an undermining of every free market pro-Western flawed leader in the world, got the axe, and Marxist revolutionaries were advanced.
Yeah, creating the best enemies our money could buy. But, of course, you can't let the American people know that we brought Fidel Castro to power because he is such a convenient enemy.
Well, you know, it's very difficult for Americans. As you stated cogently, Stan, they don't believe in evil anymore. Oh, they may believe it in theory. They know that perhaps the scriptures talk about there being a Satan, but, you know, they look at the occult and they are desensitized to it because of all of the harmless views of it in Harry Potter movies and other things. But there's a real evil agenda out there. There's real evil there. It's revelatory. It's got the capacity to possess people as it did in biblical days. I'm very concerned about the amount of New Age revelations being given under the appearance of light and glory, but these things are satanic in origin, in my opinion.
Well, there's, do you know Richard Mayberry, who writes the early one there? And he, one of his, it's his September newsletter, he was talking about his two new books he'd written, on one in the First World War, one in the Second World War. And he said, you know, as I analyze what happened, certainly during the Second World War, the last 2 years of the Second World War, they could have ended the war any time they wanted to. A million people were dying every month. And I am firmly convinced that there is a thing out there, and he had capital T for the thing, that wants death and destruction. And, you know, and this thing was in total control and prolonged that Second World War for 2 years. Well, of course, you and I would interpret that thing as Satan or the satanic forces that are out there. I don't know whether Richard Mayberry recognized that, but he certainly recognized that there was an organized evil that was perpetuating and prolonging that war. And, of course, I see that same thing as it would be, that same satanic force moving us into this cataclysmic event over in Iraq. I hope it's very short and there's very limited loss of life. I'm not certain that's what's going to happen. Only time is going to tell.
Well, I do think that it's a... this is going to... I don't think we're ever going to be free from war ever again, Stan. I don't think we'll ever have peace again. It's very sad to say, but... there is a massive war agenda, and there's a lot of death and destruction to be had. And once we get into a major global Third World War, we're never going to get our liberty back again. The Americans, unfortunately, in a knee-jerk reaction to patriotic fervor, will give the government whatever power they want. I mean, look what they've given in the relatively minor terrorist attack that we have in comparison to the mother of all terrorist acts, which would be a preemptive nuclear strike on America. That will seem like a picnic in comparison. And yet we gave away almost a third of our most essential protections under the Constitution, habeas corpus, you know, being able to bring forth a prisoner and have them explain what the charges, that's all done away with if you're named an enemy combatant. There are provisions now to create concentration camps. I believe they've already been in the process for many years. We've lost our obvious right to freedom from warrantless searches within our homes and on internet and business and telephone calls, even though I've clearly pointed out in my World Affairs brief that these things have been going on for many years. The government is just using the excuse of this terrorist attack to make them more public and get the public used to accepting them. Really, this government has been doing illegal wiretapping and for many, many years. They control the judiciary. I don't think we really have an independent judiciary anymore.
Well, it was very interesting. I read a fascinating article in the Washington Times written by a gentleman from the Cato Institute, and basically saying just what you're saying, you know, about the U.S. Patriot Act and about the home security and the TIPS program and, you know, doing away with habeas corpus and the Fourth Amendment. So I called him to get him onto one of our programs because I just felt that he was saying everything very well, the things that you and I would think. And he wanted to know if this was going to be a debate. And I said, no, I'm not going to debate you. I agree with you. I mean, what a response are you getting from other stations? He said, well, I'm going on to a lot of stations, and the conservatives there are all attacking me for being concerned about what's happening. And they say, we've got to back the president in this war, and this war against terrorism. And I was just flabbergasted to think that there are talk show hosts who profess to be conservative, all across America who are attacking somebody who's concerned about the destruction of our freedom, our constitutional rights, and this phony war on terrorism. And it is a phony war, because if we were really at war with terrorism, we would have sealed our borders. We would have done it long ago, instead of intentionally opening them up to allow the terrorists to come into this country.
That's exactly right, Stan. The government claims that we really can't effectively seal our border. We don't have the money to do so, and yet they've just announced a multi-million dollar contract to various firms to build a border fence and outpost system between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Now, how long is that? That's going to be, several hundred miles?
Oh, that's right. It's almost as long as the U.S.-Mexican border, and we're going to pay for it completely. You know, it seems like money is unlimited, even though we're running huge deficits. This government simply does whatever they want to do now, and they worry about the finances later, if at all. But this shows the real hypocrisy of not closing and sealing our own borders, what they're doing with other people. They know the value of borders when you really do want to stop incursions, but they certainly don't want to stop illegal immigration here.
They wouldn't want to offend Vicente Fox, I'd say, you know, our good friend Vicente Fox. And, of course, Vicente Fox is pushing this whole concept of Aslan, you know, and taking the five western states or southwestern states and returning them to their rightful owner, Mexico. And, you know, as you look and see what's happening to the demographics here, it's really unbelievable. In fact, I read just 2 days ago that in the hospitals in Los Angeles are being deluged with ambulances bringing in patients. They're bringing in sick patients from Mexico who don't have any money and don't have any insurance and go to Mexican hospitals, and they just bundle them off into an ambulance. They send them across the border because our hospitals are required by federal law to accept them. And we have to pay for them, and the hospitals have to pay for them. If they're public hospitals, the taxpayer. If it's the private hospitals, they just add on to your hospital bill to pay for these people being sent in here from Mexico by ambulance. Why aren't they stopping them at the border? I mean, oh, we couldn't do that. I mean, these people are sick. They need health care. What sort of madness is this, or is it something truly much more diabolical? This will destroy the health care system in California, within another year. And it's almost like it's not even happening.
Yes, it's amazing how apathetic people are now to this. I mean, government does things by mandate now and by emergency. Government by emergency is a very dangerous proposition. I mean, it seems like whatever you need to do, there's a crisis, there's an emergency, and all of a sudden under emergency powers, they simply do it. They don't even question where the money's got to come from. We've got to pay for this because there's a major catastrophe. But it's created a great deal of apathy even among legitimate legislators. They know it's like a steamroller that they can't stop anymore.
Well, I know a friend of mine was talking to Congressman Ron Paul the other day, and his comment was, nobody back here has any morals, any sense of right and wrong. They're just in this to get all the money they can out, all the power and all the glory, and they really don't care about the Constitution.
And it's very interesting, in line with that, though, that underlying that, the reason why they don't feel a sense of personal responsibility is they know that none of them have the power to control it, that there's an organization. They know there's a power structure in Washington that determines it. Everybody feels like a little pawn there, unless you're one of the major players. And you get swept into these large systems. I mean, look at the conservative Republican people, even from Utah, one of the most conservative states in the Union, and they literally become rubber stamps to anything the Bush administration wants. And it's almost like they're swept across in a fever and afraid to buck the system.
Well, I'll tell you what, I don't know how you feel about Senator Hatch, but he was not only afraid of the Republicans, he went right along with the Democrats. He was, of course, saying how he was blocking all of Bill Clinton's judicial appointments, and actually he was passing them as quickly as he could.
And I heard him on the Diane Rehm show bragging that he put through 97% of all Clinton's appointments and approved of them. He said, they thought I did that reluctantly. No, I wholeheartedly approved of those good appointments.
But of course,
I mean, he was just, you know, lying through his teeth. He's trying to please everyone. It's a very sad situation.
But, of course, even more frightening is the fact that now the Republicans are in power. Why, of course, they really wouldn't do anything to really try to get their appointments through. Oh, no, you know, we have to go to the Democrats to get their permission before we do anything. You know, when the Democrats are in party, why, they run roughshod over the laws. When the Republicans are power, they say, well, gee, we're just barely in power. We hardly only have one or two votes. Oh, we have to be representative. And they make all their excuses for their failures. I think that they are not failing accidentally. I think they're failing intentionally and betraying the trust of the American people. We're just about out of time. What are your thoughts for our listeners tonight?
Well, certainly there are many of the congressmen, I believe, that are fully involved in conspiring to take down our Constitution. I'm reminded of what Ron Paul just wrote the other day about during that hearing on the war resolution where Chairman Hyde, a Republican from Illinois, has denigrated the Constitution in violation of his very oath. And CNN and the recording service of the Congress, which recorded that remark, claimed that they'd had technical difficulties and there was no record of it. In other words, they covered up for his disparaging remarks about the Constitution and the war powers of Congress. So, but nevertheless, there are the people that they simply manipulate, and they know how to, that aren't direct conspirators, that they know how to manipulate, and unfortunately that involves at least 75% of Congress, so I'm not optimistic about our ability to turn this around nationally.
Well, all we can do is do our best. I think that's what we're called to do, and I think we're going to have to get the people educated and informed, and that is the contribution I can make, and of course we rely upon you to keep us advised as to you know, so many of the things that are going on there. I want to thank you again for being with us tonight. Twice in one day is a real honor and real pleasure, and I'm always fascinated by your appraisal of things.
Thank you, Stan. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
And let's get that telephone number out just one more time.
Office number is 801-224-4746.
That's 801-224-4746. If you're interested in getting the World Affairs Brief and finding out how to get it on a regular basis. Thank you so much, Joel. Good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye. All right, that was Joel Skousen, and I hope you enjoy him. I always enjoy Joel's point of view. He's a very provocative individual. He's done a lot of thought, and he has a lot of contacts. And, well, only time is going to see, tell us what's going to happen. So in the meantime, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival, because if the American people don't turn back to God, why, God is going to turn his back on this country forever. And then lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Pray for my family and for my staff. And so until tomorrow, Monday now, at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Well, the Lord was
smiling at you.
Yes, most definitely. I looked at that. I was really fighting evil back then.
You're probably...
Isn't that amazing?
Well, you know, Jean, this is the most amazing thing we talk about, but it really is true. And the Lord is here, and, you know, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the things that happen, and I just can't believe they happen in my life.
Yeah. And for Jim and I to do all what we do.
I know, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, you know, anytime it's amazing, you can get out of it. You know, so I appreciate you know, the Lord. Very good speakers, you know, why you go over there, and then we can put them up on the air.
Yeah, Joan Ferris and I would like a 2-hour program sometime in January.
Sure.
And we're going to connect international down to local.
Fine.
And we're going to go into all the issues, too.
I don't have my January.
Oh, look at this. Ooh, this is good.
You've had those before, haven't you?
No.